Well, we have reached the end of another year and reached our Christmas New Year's special on dreamlandandunknowncountry.com, and it's going to be quite incredible, as you will hear in a few minutes. The first special I've ever done that I could say truthfully is a historic moment in not only the Close Encounter experience, but also in the world at large. And you'll see why in a few minutes. It has been an extraordinary year. We finally got into the new website. It's working beautifully. It is very exciting, and I'm so glad that it's finally there. I've gone deeper into the Close Encounter experience than I ever thought possible, and am going deeper and deeper every day. It has become my life, and I know that that's true of some of you and more every day, and I think that it is probably going to continue to expand slowly, but it is going to expand. I don't know what 2020 will bring. It could bring extraordinary change. It's always possible in this world of ours, but I do know this. It will bring more love in our lives and more potential to feed our souls in this wonderful experience that we call the living world. So, on that note, Merry Christmas to everyone. May you have a joyous season of giving. And you know, this Christmas season goes back very, very far to even before the Christian era. It was the Roman Saturnalia and celebrated all over the world when the sun began to return from its annual excursion southward, and everyone realized that it wasn't over. The fat lady had not yet sung, and we're going to go on for another year. Maybe that will be true again. I certainly hope it is. I love you very much, all of you. Thank you for being part of Dreamland and part of unknowncountry.com. Let's join hands for the adventure and get ready for 2020. This is Dreamland's 2019-2020 Christmas New Year's special. We've got a truly incredible special. Actually, it's a historic special. Two prominent scientists are going to be talking about their close encounter experiences and how those experiences have affected their work. And I hope that this is just the beginning of a completely new era in science, because both of these scientists are prominent enough to where they are going to encourage others to come out and say, yes, it happened to me. Yes, I am in touch with the visitors. And yes, it is a useful relationship. Or to say to themselves, wait a minute, look what's happening here. These people are making serious, important, practical advances that are also advancing their careers. Why not me? And I think that the academic community is already beginning to sit up and take notice of prominent academics like Jeff Kripal and Diana Walsh-Pasulka and so many others who are saying, let's take a new, deeper, and more sophisticated look at this whole experience that is now called Close Encounter, that is so much part of the weave of human experience and human culture throughout all of our history. But, as I point out in the New World, as World War II ended and it began to appear that we could destroy ourselves, this strange experience of seeing lights and objects in the skies, of having close encounters with strange beings that we once called fairy folk or djinn or all sorts of things and now call aliens, ramped up massively until it is what it is today. The most extraordinary experience a human being can have, and more one that people are turning toward and getting engaged in. Is it dangerous? Is it a mistake? I don't know. But that's what the future's all about, isn't it? I know my experience with the visitors was no mistake. It started out very hard, but I made it into something that I think is worth a life that's worth living. Now, at the very end of the show, I'm going to do something very special. Over the years, I have never succeeded in getting video of the visitors. But recently, I got a sleep app. That is to say, it records what happens during sleep. And to my amazement, a couple of times, it recorded some things that I believe relate to the visitors. Now, what you're going to hear at the end is me talking, basically. There's a little sound that may be an utterance that they make that's typical of when an encounter is over. There's this little sigh, and you'll hear that. Now, I want to explain, as I will at the end of the show again, I have no conscious memory of this, and yet it sure doesn't sound like normal sleep talking at all. I'm talking to somebody who is there, and it's quite fascinating. And when you hear it, you're going to hear that, hey, he's really probably having a pretty good time with this, which apparently I am. I wish I could say more. I wish I knew more. But let's make 2020 the year of the breakthrough. Can that happen? Well, the visitors have said to me, they said this to me now 2 weeks ago Tuesday out in the desert in 29 Palms in a very brief, just seconds long meeting, that this was an inflection point. And maybe the next few months or year, this year will be an inflection point, because after all, between 2017 and 2019, we've made extraordinary progress. And now here we are at the end of the year, talking to two prominent scientists who are openly talking about two of the most fascinating close encounter experiences you're ever going to hear about. Now, before we go on, though, I want to tell you a little bit about what's coming up on unknowncountry.com. The site's going to get bigger and better. I'm hoping to move more into video in more different areas of the site. This has been a bit of a challenge with the old site, but it's going to be much easier now, and that's on my agenda for 2020. Also, we've got already a lot of great shows lined up. Linda Moulton Howe is going to be back in the second week of January, I believe, with a brain bender, and I'm telling you, I'm not kidding, you're going to agree with me when you hear it. We had a lot of fun. We just did this show yesterday. Haven't done a show, of course, with John Hogue yet. We'll do that right at the beginning of the year. Our first show of 2020, as it usually is every year, will be a show with John Hogue, and he will make you angry, he will infuriate you, he will satisfy you, make you happy. He'll do it all. Because he's John Hogue, and that's just what he does. As always, we're going to be right at the cutting edge of the close encounter experience. If it's happening anywhere, it's happening here, because it actually is happening to me right now, big time. I am more involved with the visitors right now, at this time in my life, than I have been at any other time before. And it is a rich, complex, extraordinary experience. It involves our dead. It involves non-human, non-physical entities. It involves human beings who I interact with on two different levels at the same time. It involves physical beings that look to me like aliens and may very well be that. Probably are, in fact. So it involves all of the above. And it is an incredibly dynamic, intense experience. I often spend almost an entire night engaged in the experience. Sleep is like a hobby for me now. And, you know, I want you to engage insofar as you wish to engage also. And I want you to understand and to explore. And above all, to just share the excitement that's here, the wonder, the discoveries, all of it. It's all here. It's all unfolding right here on Unknown Country. And the other similar sites, Earth Files, the other sites like this, I'm not the only one in the world. But however, this is the only one where there is a direct, ongoing, close encounter experience that is forming the aim of the whole website. And that is true. I think that is absolutely unique in the world. It's here. I'm in contact. It's as simple as that. And can I prove it? Yeah, to a degree, it's possible. I think with all the witnesses and the implant that's there and all of that stuff, I can certainly prove that something is going on. Do I have proof of aliens walking into my living room under video observation that cannot be debunked? Well, there is no video that can't be debunked, first off. Second, no, I don't have that yet. And maybe I never will get it. But that does not mean I won't keep trying. I've been trying for a long, long time. So who knows, or who could ever possibly guess, what adventures lie in wait for us in 2020? One thing I learned about the old Chinese curse, may you live in interesting times, it's always true. And thank God for that. Uninteresting, I personally do not want. Although an occasional quiet afternoon lying under a tree reading an old mystery novel or a thriller or something would be kind of pleasant. It ain't going to happen, though. That's not how Whitley rolls. Okay, so our first guest up is going to be Dr. Ed Belbruno. Our second, Dr. Deep Prasad. They have both had powerful and life-changing close encounters. They are both very prominent in their fields of science. And they are here now talking to us. Free Dreamlanders, you're going to get the whole show this week. And because it's too important, I can't not let you listen to Deep Prasad and Ed Belbruno, both in the interest of trying to induce you to subscribe. But I want to ask you right now to do just that. Put the show on pause, go to unknowncountry.com, start a subscription, then you can start listening again. This website is unique in the world, and it is one of the places where contact really is unfolding. It really is, right here. So go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe today. Keep us keeping on for 2020. I'm honored to be talking to Dr. Ed Belbruno today. I think he has played a very, very important role in the old world that has a lot to do with the new world, and we'll be talking about that over the course of the show. He is a mathematician and astrophysicist, the winner of the 2018 Humboldt Award, Germany's award to a leading scientist practicing his work outside of Germany. It's one of the great awards in mathematics in this world. He has been named on a number of lists among the top 10 scientists in the world, but it does not stop there because he is also a brilliant artist, and his work has a deeply satisfying and exciting effect on the viewer. It's serious art, beautiful art. You can find out more about Ed and his work at edbelbruno.com. Ed, welcome to Dreamland.
Thanks, Whitley. Glad to be here.
Ed, I want to thank you from the beginning for two things. One is the time you went on Dreamland anonymously and talked about your experiences. That was a very, very important moment because it led you to gradually decide to go ahead and say some things about them publicly. And second, the fact that you allowed me to use your name in A New World, because I believe that what happened to you is an offer. I think that it can happen to lots of people, scientists and intellectuals that it can enrich our world immeasurably if things go right. But before we go into that, I want to talk about some of the most interesting things about you, which is the way you relate science and math to your art. His art, folks, you've got to go on his website, and if you get a chance to see or buy some of his paintings, be well worth doing. They're richly alive. So, Ed, can you talk to that a little bit?
Let me see. My art is something I've done since I was born, actually. I did my first serious oil painting. It was oil painting when I was 5 years old. And my mom was down shopping in a town called New London, Connecticut. And without knowing anything about art, never having done it before, I just walked into a hobby shop while she was shopping and randomly bought some art supplies. I sort of knew exactly what to get. And I ended up painting a beautiful painting, actually, of a spacecraft floating in a red background. It was supposed to be space to me, but it was red. And that painting came out so good that a few years ago in New York at Gallery 61 in Manhattan, in a group show I was in, they actually used that painting to advertise the whole show. So that was something I did at five, and it's sort of always been with me. My next major painting, I would say, was when I was 11, and it was a painting of looking at Saturn in the sky on the ground of Titan. And that was inspired by the wonderful astronomical artist Chesley Bonestell. And as a young kid, I was really inspired by him when I saw a piece at the Hayden Planetarium, and I painted my own. And I thought it came out just as good, actually. my art is something I've pursued over the years. It's evolved now to very abstract expressionist pieces. I like to pride myself now that they're done from the subconscious. So I typically get myself in what sports figures or artists or people in any kind of art would understand in the zone, where I sort of lose track of time. And for me, 5 minutes goes by, but it's really like 5 hours. And in that zone is when I paint. It's sort of pure creativity as far as I can define it. I just wrote an article for Scientific American, which will be talking about this. And you're in this sort of zone or discovery mode of pure creativity, really, for hours when you do a painting. Now, in the scientific world, if I was doing a scientific work in mathematics, for example, you get creativity in that too, but it's very short. It might be a fraction of a second. And then the rest of your time is just very, very hard work to see that through. So art is a bit more challenging, at least the abstract expressionist art, because you have to be in that mode for hours, which is exhausting. And you really can't do that too much. It just wears you down. However, I have to say that many years ago, what got my science career really launched is when I had a wonderful opportunity to work at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab. And during that time, I came up with a new route to the moon, which people sort of laughed at because they felt, well, it uses chaos theory. And at that time, NASA didn't use that in their trajectory design. But I was using it to find low-fuel ways to go to the moon. And I was inspired to find the first one, which actually gave rise to this whole subject now of low-energy transfers to the moon. I got inspired to find that, actually, by doing a painting. And by looking at the brushstrokes of a painting, I went to the NASA computer, and lo and behold, the brushstrokes actually gave rise to a whole new class of very, very important transfers to the moon, and one in particular was used to rescue an errant Japanese spacecraft in 1991 and get it to the moon. So that all came from a painting. So there's a synergy where I use my insight from doing paintings, and if you sort of look at the painting carefully enough, you can sort of get from that stuff you can use in science. Now, since then, I've done many, many more paintings, and who knows what those paintings are saying? They could be speaking and saying something really important. I guess each one has its own story, but I haven't focused on that. I just keep doing them.
Well, you know, it's interesting the way, as you talked, the way I could hear the relationship between your art and your work, your scientific work. And it's unusual when a person would find that the creative side of the brain working in just that way. So it's exciting to hear. I think it's, you have a remarkable mind, Ed. I mean, but you already know that. You're in there, right?
Well, it's my worst enemy, too. So.
Yeah, well, don't speak just for yourself, please. We're all like that. In any case, you mentioned that the painting that you did at 5 was a painting of a spaceship. Do you know why that would be?
Well, I was very inspired by space as a young kid. I grew up in the 60s when going to the moon was a big deal. So I was inundated with that. And I probably saw a magazine or something at that age, which said, that's pretty cool. I want to try to make that. And it was probably something along those lines. But I was always very much interested in space. And everything I've done has really involved that. And I think much, much so to the point that it goes beyond, I think, just my interest from growing up at that really exciting era.
Yeah, I can understand that. Of course, I grew up in the 50s when somewhat less dramatic discoveries were being made. And I was obsessed with Mars, and I was obsessed because we all thought the UFOs were coming from Mars. And I was heavily involved in that as a child, as you know. So I was wondering if there was something there, but I think that what you're saying is that it was basically the social milieu, that a cultural milieu that existed at the time that inspired you.
Yeah, I mean, everywhere you turned in the latter 60s, everywhere you turned was space and something in space. We landed on the moon in 69, and it was constantly in the news. The magazines had it. And for a young kid growing up at that time, everything I looked at had space on it. That could have been a big influence.
So now I would like to go on, if I can, to the incident that happened in Wyoming on October the 2nd, 1991. But before we go there, I'd like to say I have known one other scientist who had a direct influence of the sort that you experienced there. And that was the Nobel Prize-winning chemist, Carey Mullis, who had an encounter in his country home in Northern California some years after that. He was out walking, and he suddenly saw what looked to him like a raccoon standing there looking up at him, and it said, "Good evening, Dr. Mullis." And then he didn't remember anything until he found himself back at the house, as I recall. Or it disappeared or something. But he always felt it had an influence in his thinking and his work. And his daughter disappeared for quite a long time at the same time. So it was an extraordinary night for them. He writes about it in his autobiography. And, of course, we talked about it endlessly, as you may imagine, because he'd read all my books because of what happened to him. So what happened to you on that night on that lonely road in Wyoming back in the 1990s?
Well, I can describe that now very objectively, actually, without getting too emotional. I've talked about it so many times. When it first happened, of course, when you have these encounters, they're, you know, something you don't understand in your life and you're confronted with it, it impacts you hugely because we're so used to having life being so-called predictable. Our whole society tries to be predictable. And if you don't behave within a certain strict guidelines, you're viewed as weird. And if you can't explain something, people don't talk about it. So if you're if you see something really weird, it's usually on a movie. You know, you can sit back like Close Encounters and see something like that and leave the theater. And after you've had your popcorn, everything is just fine. But if you were actually out there and you see something like, say, was in that movie, it's a totally different story. I mean, you're not in your frame of reference, and it's really, really frightening because it's something which you never learned or never even told about, and suddenly you're confronted with it. So that particular night, I was driving back. I was driving from L.A. with my girlfriend at the time to St. Paul, Minnesota, of all places, from L.A. to St. Paul, from a beautiful L.A. climate to American Siberia, as F. Scott Fitzgerald, I think, said. So we were driving cross-country, and we're entered, after driving for a while, entered southern Wyoming. And I had my Jeep, you know, my old Jeep Wrangler, soft top, and I had a lot of paintings in it because I was moving paintings across country. And we stopped at a gas station or a rest stop in outside of Casper, Wyoming. And I wanted to basically take a rest and then drive north up to Route 90, which is the interstate, and then get a hotel because I knew a lot were up there. And then head east on Route 90 and go to St. Paul as quickly as possible because I just wasn't a fan of driving for days. So my girlfriend, though, she really didn't want to do that. She wanted to explore, you know, not go directly to St. Paul, but go a little bit beyond. Little beyond Casper in northern Wyoming and take a left and go to some place where there was hot springs at, you know, it was 9 o'clock at night and I didn't know where I was going. I had very little gas. I didn't even know where the gas stations were. So I wasn't too keen on doing that. And then she wanted to take another route instead of going up the Route 90, take a little right down some unknown road, some tiny road north of Casper. And I didn't want to do that. And all this results in an argument, because I was so determined just to go Route 90, and she wanted to explore. Well, as you can imagine, I lost the argument, and we found ourselves on this small road north of Casper heading east. Went east towards a town called Gillette, Wyoming, through Thunder Basin National Grasslands. So, here it is, 9 o'clock at night. We take a right, and I'm saying to myself, my God, we have like 100 miles to go or 75 miles, you know, close to 100 miles to go through basically nothing. Thunder Basin National Grasslands, there's nothing there. There's no gas stations. There were no towns. This is the only town you come to is after Thunder Basin, which is Gillette. But you have to first go to this little tiny truck stop town called Wright, Wyoming, and then go north from there to Gillette. So Wright is really the town, and it was really a nothing town. So that was the best I could hope for, and I just sort of said, okay, I'll do it. And that resolved the argument. So I take a right, and we're headed towards that destination, and I'm very conscious of my gas not being great. We're headed down there, and it was October, beginning of October 1991. And when I made this trip, leaving L.A. a few days earlier, I did it with the intent of I just had to get out of L.A. because I've been working for JPL for some time and for about 5 years, and came up with this new route to the moon. And the Japanese spacecraft was actually using my route at that time. And I figured, well, you know, now's a good time to take a break from aerospace engineering and head to Minneapolis, St. Paul, where I was going, and become a full-time artist for a while. So with all that said, I figured here's a good chance to do it. If the Japanese spaceships gets there, then that's going to be really great for my career, and that's going to be wonderful. If it doesn't get there, then I'm glad I'm not doing aerospace anymore. So either way, it was a good time to take a break. And that's what I was doing. So I'm driving down this road, and it was a very balmy night. Typically, in that part of the country, the Midwest, it could be really hot. It can be cold. It can be anything. Usually at the beginning of October, it's not going to be really that warm. But this night was very, very foggy, and it was very balmy. And I remember there's a lot of fog everywhere. And driving down this tiny road heading east, there, you could see lots of animals on the side of the road, so you had to drive slow not to hit them. And the whole atmosphere was just really unusual. So I'm driving for a long time, hours, at least a couple hours. And finally, I see a sign come up, and it says Wright, Wyoming, something like 15 miles. And I felt a sigh of relief come over me because my gas was getting really low. And my girlfriend at the time, she was not a big talker, so it was a pretty lonely drive. As I noticed that sign, I saw another sign come up saying, you're entering Thunder Basin National Grasslands. So I'm on the road, and all you could really see was a dark, dark night. And all you could really see was like silhouettes of trees, sagebrush blowing around, you know, if you look close enough. And basically, there wasn't much there. North of that area are mountains. So, in any event, Thunder Basin is just what it's supposed to be. It's a basin. So you start to head down. You're going into the bowl of the basin. And as I'm heading down, I notice way off in the distance a red light. And I figured that's a pretty unusual with the blizzard because it was extremely bright. And I was just wondering what a light was doing in the middle of this area so late at night. And you know, it was probably like around 11 o'clock at that point. I'd been driving for a few couple hours. And so I'm heading down into Thunder Basin National Grasslands in this bowl-shaped region. And I see this really bright red light off in the distance. And I mentioned to my friend, I said, this probably is a construction site, because when you see something like this, again, you're not at the movies anymore. So when you see something like this, you're struggling to find excuses to sort of write it off as something safe. Otherwise, you're going to scare yourself, right? So I said, well, you know, it's got to be a construction site. And in retrospect, that was really a ridiculous thing to say. So as I'm driving down Thunder Basin, I'm getting closer to it, and I could see that the light was getting brighter. And I just really started to scratch my head, saying, you know, to myself, what the heck is that? And I said, it must be a pretty big construction site. So the road finally levels off. And when it levels off, this light is directly in front of me now on a level road at the bottom of the bowl. And it's directly in front of me. And I'm figuring from before I got there, it was just a little tiny construction site, and there was probably a little light there. And what I see in front of me instead is quite different. It's a very, very bright light on the road directly in front of me. And as I got closer to it, maybe about a mile away or about a half a mile away, it wasn't on the side of the road. It was actually right smack in the middle of the road. And it was huge. It wasn't just a little light. It was actually, it looked like the side of a building. So I immediately slowed down, and I got maybe quite close, maybe a few hundred feet away, and saw that it was a square light sitting off the road. So it was like the boundary of a square, but it was sitting off of the road. So I put my brakes on, and I'm staring at this thing, and I'm saying to my passenger friend, what the heck is that? I mean, I like science fiction. I've always been a science fiction buff. I've read lots of science fiction books, and you know, I reference points to everything. But I never, ever, even in my science fiction books, saw nothing like this. It was perfectly square. It was almost like a doorway to another dimension. The only way I could think of it is like it wasn't something I've ever had any reference to. And as I got closer to it, I edged closer, and as I got closer, now maybe 100 feet away, this thing was about 40 feet long. It went way off the side of the road on both sides. So the road was literally blocked. I mean, I could not go any further. And before I even continue, I wanted to mention I was driving for 2 hours on this small road to get to where I was. And as I recall, there was not a car passed me in either direction, which is also very unusual. So in any event, I'm sitting in front of this thing, and I'm like saying, you know, holy S, you know, this is really strange. And so being an aerospace kind of guy and working for fabulous places like JPL, and I'm trying to think, well, what could this be, you know? And then I noticed that the red object I was looking at which was a boundary of a square, it was actually sitting way off of the road, and it was sitting in the middle of a much bigger object, which was jet black, and that was on the road. So it's on the road, this gigantic black square object. In the middle of it was that boundary of a very bright red light. That's where I originally saw it in the distance. I wasn't close enough to really see exactly what it was, but it was pretty unusual. So I was speechless, needless to say. And we must have sat there for a good 10 minutes looking at this. And my friend wasn't saying anything. She was actually, by profession, was a massage therapist. And she was very like in that kind of world of healing and therapy. So she wasn't really used to this. I wasn't either. I don't know how one could get used to that. But so I sat there watching it and just mystified. But I was afraid to get out because I didn't know what this was. And again, if you're looking at a TV program, you can have some of your popcorn and sort of enjoy the ride. When you're actually in the middle of a place like this late at night and you have this thing in front of you, it is a completely different feeling. It's actually frightening, although I'm sort of an explorer type. So I was saying, part of my mood was saying, hey, this is pretty cool. What is this thing? And then what happened was it started to lift off of the ground and it went straight up. Maybe about 50 feet. That was it. The bottom of it was 50 feet. And then you could really see that it was a giant black square with this red light, which was also a square in the middle of it. And when it rose up with the ground like that, that's when I knew and didn't make a single any noise. When that happened, I knew this was really not from anything I've ever seen before. So the only conclusion I could have made that at that moment was that, well, this must be some top secret military thing or else it's really something from another world. And I'm very lucky to be seeing it. And after it sat there over the road for about 5 minutes, it starts to turn sideways. So what I was looking at, which was enormous, was like the size of the side of a small building. What that was the back of it. So as it started to turn, the back of this object starts to go to the right. And then what was revealed in front of me was this giant object, probably many times bigger than the road, maybe four or five times bigger than the road. It was probably like 150 feet long. It was easily 40 feet high, and it was a long rectangle with a slight blue glow in the middle. And it just hung there over the road, high up in the air, maybe 100 feet in the air at this point. And then it goes up and down in the back, up and down in the front, like it was doing a little show. It was like saying hello in its own way. And as it sat there, my friend said, why don't you get out and go under it? And I just yell out to her, why don't you go under this thing? I said, I'm not going to get out there and go under that. I said, I don't know what the hell this thing is.
She's an interesting person.
Yeah, right. She wants me to go out and get under it.
She's so, like my wife. She also, you go out in the woods and see if they're there. Go
exactly.
Ahead.
Exactly. And it's one thing, looking at a TV program, it's another thing when you're actually confronted by this. And then what happened was, but at no time did it feel threatening. It just felt like this is weird. And then it starts to move off of the road, perpendicular to the road, but high up off of the road. And then it goes up towards the mountains that were off in the distance. When it got far enough away from the road, I got out. And then I'm standing there where it was, and I'm watching this thing way off in the distance go towards the mountains. You could see the little red light in the back of it as it was going away. And I'm looking at my Jeep facing me, and I'm saying to myself, this is like something you couldn't do a movie like this. I mean, this is like a movie script. So I get back in the car, and at this point, I am absolutely, my mind is going a million miles per minute as to what just happened. And I grabbed the steering wheel and I just was almost in a top. I was almost in automatic way of, I wasn't thinking. And I just said, sort of gradually moved the car forward. My friend was not saying anything, of course. She was probably more stunned than I was. And I moved. I got out of there and started driving down the road. And I was just so much in thought, I didn't even know where I was. And the next thing I know, I feel her shaking me, and she's shaking my shoulder violently. And she says in this very hysterical voice, they're waiting for us up there. And I shake my head and say, who the hell's waiting for us? And then I notice on the side of the road, the road starts oscillating in light, a white light, like a strobe light, light like you would see in a discotheque or something, but vastly more bright. And it was on the left side of the road. It was oscillating on and off. And I start to slow down because I really want to see this. I my ego was damaged because I didn't get out when she wanted me to, where the rectangle was. So I said, now I'm going to get out and I'm going to see what the hell's there. But now it really was frightening, because when this light was oscillating like this, a bright white light, it really was frightening. And every red flag in my body went off, and as sort of the red flags were saying, get out of there. But I suppose that was sort of triggered by the fact that my friend started screaming. And as I started to slow down, I looked over the left and I saw that there were figures standing around, quite a few of them. And they were standing on around the ground where the ground was lit up. The ground was lit up in this bright white light, and they're all standing around it. Every time it oscillated, you could see them. So I said, my God, you know, who are those people? So I started to slow down and by pulling to the right a little bit, and my friend really got upset, and she started screaming. She was literally screaming and said, I'm getting out. I'm going to get out of the car now and start running. So she starts to reach for the door to open the door up, and I'm saying to myself, that's the last thing I need, is for her to go running through the countryside where I was with those things over to the left. And it was really much of a panic feeling. So the best I could do was get out of there. So I hit the accelerator and moved away so she wouldn't do that. And I noticed up in the sky, there was a white light following my car. It was pretty high up, but it was tracking my car because I saw it up in the air. And about 10 minutes later, I got to Wright, Wyoming. And at this point, I was out of Thunder Basin, and I looked back in the mirror, and you could see lots of activity going on where I just was. So I don't know what it was, but we got on the road to go to Gillette, which was now about 40 miles north, and this little road turned into a bigger one. And I was absolutely blown away at this point, because the second encounter we had was really scary. The first one was not, but the second one was. And as I went north to Gillette, I remember I kept saying over and over to my friend, it's so late. I just kept saying over and over again, it is so late. We're never, ever going to get a hotel at this time, you know? And the clock said something like 2 or 3 in the morning. And I said, we're never going to get a hotel here. And we finally did see a light on. There was a hotel open. We go inside. It was filled with hunters, actually, people going to go hunting. And I got a room, and I noticed it was like 3 in the morning. Now, I'm an artist, so I carefully sketched everything I saw. And we went to sleep and got up in the morning and got out of there. Now, the most unusual thing about it, well, there's a lot of unusual things about this. So eventually we get to St. Paul, Minnesota. I get to St. Paul, Minnesota, and I go to her house, you know, where she lived. That's where I was going to stay for a little bit. And during that time, I find out that the Japanese space probe that I designed this trajectory for, that saved their mission and saved my career, and really the results from this painting I had done a few years earlier, the Japanese spacecraft was actually, I found, arrived at the moon. So my trajectory really worked. And I got that trajectory under very mysterious circumstances as well. I backtracked now a year and a half earlier. This is like early 90, and I was leaving JPL because they lost faith in my work, because I was designing these chaotic routes to the moon for no fuel, and they thought it would never work. And they let me go. But as I was leaving my job, that's when I had the opportunity to rescue an errant Japanese mission where they had 2 spacecraft in Earth orbit. This was in early 90, and one went off to the moon and never made it. And they wanted to salvage their mission desperately. And someone contacted me from NASA and said, we're really desperate. We've heard about your crazy work. He used other words. And we'll try anything at this point. And as soon as he said that to me, I knew in a flash how to rescue this Japanese mission. And the idea came to me in such a weird way that it was one of those miracles of a eureka moment, really. And the rescue really was to take the other craft that was never designed to go to the moon, that was supposed to be a relay for the one that failed, to get that to the moon, and it had basically no fuel, but on this route that I found, we were able to do it. We actually found the route, and a year to the day in April of 91, they actually started it out. So for me, there was a lot riding, not to make a pun, there was a lot riding on that trajectory to the moon. So any event, when I got to St. Paul, Minnesota, and around, you know, a few months later, I find out that the Japanese spacecraft actually got there successfully. And Carl Sagan, who was running the Planetary Society in Pasadena, wanted me to write a story for their magazine called The Planetary Report. And I wrote it. And then particularly, they wanted me to write down how I found this route to the moon and how the Japanese spacecraft was rescued, which I gladly did. And I wrote down, yes, on October 2nd, 1991, that Japanese spacecraft arrived at the moon. And when I wrote that down for my article that he was going to be reading, I had to stop. And suddenly this thought came over me that just literally, I'll never forget it. I suddenly realized that the time that Japanese spacecraft got to the moon on October 2nd, 91 was the same time I ran into that rectangle on the road. When that happened, I was speechless because that was a synchronicity that you couldn't even dream of if you had to. It was so unusual.
No.
So when that happened, you know, however I found that trajectory, it worked. It saved my career. It saved their spacecraft. It was coincidental that it happened when I had that very unusual experience out in Wyoming with whatever I ran into.
But I think you sense there's some connection. Do you think that you, where did the calculations come from? You're working around a very fascinating mystery here.
Yes. Well, you know, when that guy knocked on my door that day and told me what happened to the Japanese mission, that it failed and that they wanted to get the relay craft to the moon. It had no fuel in it. And he said, we have tried all kinds of trajectories. None of them work. And we're really desperate. And we're going to see if any of your work can do anything with this. My first reaction was, I want nothing to do with this. But then something came over me where it was like, I just can't describe it. It was like someone hit a switch or something. And I just literally saw the answer, and I just knew this was going to work. And it was so spontaneous, and the guy showing up exactly the time he did, was the timing of that was so unusual as well, because when he showed up about a minute later, I had come to terms within myself to leave NASA and not try to convince them anymore that my work was valid. And just let it all go. I did this major letting go in myself. And it was right exactly at that moment, he showed up and posed that problem to me. And the answer jumped to my mind so quickly that it was not anything I could explain.
You know, you're talking about a really very strange something. You know, I never was able to get Carrie to talk about it on the show, unfortunately, it wasn't a question really, because there was nothing as definite. He just sensed some kind of connection that he couldn't put into words. And you're closer, Ed. I think that's fascinating because in a new world, what I'm doing is basically outlining what I think could be a way of, posing ourselves as available for the input of information. And it is not going to be scientists sitting down across a table from weird little aliens. It's going to be something deeper and something that is deeply within us. And I think that's exactly what you're describing.
Yeah, it was very deep. And
yeah,
it was a letting go I had. Also, a few months earlier, before that, this was April 90 and January 90, is when I was told that the that that the Jet Propulsion Lab had lost faith in my work, and they wanted me to leave whenever I could find a job. They weren't going to fire me, but they said, you have to leave at some point soon, the next few months. It was so devastating to hear that, that in January of that year when it happened, I went to myself, I was asking for help.
Yeah, it sounds like you got it.
Help. Yeah, whatever out there, I need some help. I just need help. Please find a way to get me out of this mess, because I was leaving. I had no job. I was being let go. I was in debt. I'd risked 5 years of research for nothing, and it was a terrible situation. And I believe I got answered, and that's the way it came.
Yeah,
it was a very unusual answer.
I think it's an extraordinary answer. I wonder if you'd like to talk about if you've had any other encounter sort of related experiences in your life.
You see, so first of all, I just want to clarify for the audience that I'm a scientist, mathematician, and I'm not going to make any claims that I understand what this is. It's definitely a phenomenon. It's one which had a huge impact on my life. Whether or not it was just a pure creative synchronistic lucky situation that happened at the right time, where the thing got to the moon when it did, when I had to happen to see that thing on the road, that's when this thing got to the moon. How all that's connected, you know, one could be a hardcore scientist and say pure luck, just luck. You could take that route, or you could take a different route and say they're connected. Now, if you take the route it's connected, then you really have to ask, well, what is it you're connecting? What the heck did I see in Wyoming? What was all that about? And to take a hard look at it. I gave a lecture at Princeton University on this, actually. Not at Princeton University, near Princeton, and I invited the faculty, and a number showed up, and they took it very serious because I described it as a phenomenon. And I asked the audience, I said, has anybody ever seen a craft like that, anything like that? And nobody has. Now, I did read in some book someone did see a rectangular object like that. Whitley, you would know. But in any event, when you ask of other things that happened, they'd also be phenomenon, and they would be related to who knows what. Now, I do know that before I took that trip across country, and I was getting ready to leave Los Angeles, it was a few months earlier, I remember there was a period there I kept waking up, and I'd wake up, I think I was awake, and open my eyes up, and instead of seeing the bedroom, I saw like someone cut out an image in front of my face, and instead I saw this panorama of mountains, mountainscapes, and it was like I was flying over them, like I was being shown a tour of this. And it was like someone was showing me a tour, and then it would last for a good minute or two, and then I'd wake up eventually. But I was awake. I was definitely awake.
You know, and, Ed, just before we go on, folks, if you read in A New World, there's a chapter called The Fields of Asphodel. I had the exact experience Ed is describing in July of 2019. I had no idea until this moment you'd ever had an experience like that. I'm just floored.
Yeah, there were many of them. That happened many times, and it was usually the same thing. It was mountain ranges. But it turned out to be more than that. I could go on, but at that time, I'm talking about that time now, it was that. And then there were a few nights during that summer when that was going on where I'd wake up, get up to go to the bathroom, you know, fully awake, get back in bed, and I had the lights on in my living room, look in the living room, and I'd see what I thought were two creatures there of some type. And they were like in looking around my living room and looking at me instead of like through me. And, they didn't seem threatening or anything. They were just doing that. And I said to myself, I just obviously must be dreaming. And this is sort of a residue of that. And I saw that for a number of nights. They're the same two things sort of looking around my living room. And it was around the time that I had those, I call those cutouts, where you see the cutout image in the mountain ranges. So I just wrote the whole thing off to a very active, being a scientist, I wrote it off to a very active dream state that stays with you when you wake up. Again, who knows? I'm not going to even try to guess what that was. But to me, it is a little bit coincidental that as that was going on, a few months later, I had that spectacular experience in the Midwest. So there is something going on, and it could be just pure coincidence. One could take that approach, but it could be something more. And if it's more, then you'd have to ask yourself, what is it?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think it's very important not to try to nail it down, because people jump to conclusions as soon as they hear a story like this. Oh, he had an encounter with aliens. But that just is not enough. That kind of pushes the whole thing away. It's like my wife used to say, the human species is too young to have beliefs. What we need are good questions. And I think that's where we need to leave experiences like this in the realm of question. Therefore, that enables them to grow and become part of our creative process, both intellectually and artistically, in your case, I think. So I want to thank you for being so open about it. This is the best thing I've ever heard. I've listened to everything you've ever said about it, including the original one on Dreamland in 2009. Mm-hmm. And this is beautiful. I thank you so much for it, Ed. It's really a lovely, lovely Christmas present in a way.
Yeah, well, my pleasure. And again, I'm not going to say for one second this is anything related to UFOs or aliens or anything like that. We simply don't know what such things could be. And again, we answer
the question, we close the door. It's not time to close the door.
No, it's not. When you think of the fact that we don't even know where something like 98% of the matter of the universe is, we don't even know what quantum entanglement is. There's so many unknowns that we don't know.
Yeah.
And you take our evolution now, which is only 5 million years from apes, and you say, well, what would it be like 5 million years from now? Or how about 200 million years? It could be such an advanced life form. It could be standing in front of, you waving, and you'd never see it. So we just don't know.
Ed, have a great Christmas and a great holiday season. And folks, remember, the more contact we achieve, the more scientists and people like Ed are going to be able to take advantage of what the visitors have to offer. My book, A New World, discusses this, of course, extensively. Ed, thank you so much.
Thank you, Whitley.
Free Dreamlanders, I am not going to cut this off, because Deep Prasad's part of the show needs to be heard as well by everybody. But I would ask you in this brief pause to stop what you're doing, go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe. There is no other site in the world like it, and that is literally, literally true. There is nothing like this on Earth. Nothing has even happened like this before. So support it. Put your money up. $5 a month is not a lot of money. Go to unknowncountry.com and subscribe, and then come back and listen to Deep Prasad tell his amazing story. Next, we're going to be talking to another scientist who has had a close encounter experience, or rather a group of them, and is perfectly willing to talk about it. And I'm pretty sure that he and Ed Belbruno are the beginning of quite a change in that community, which has been kind of locked into a situation where people dared not speak out. But now that Louis Elizondo has released UFO video, and there is so much else happening, that it's no longer possible to say that this is nothing. and it is simply something in people's minds, especially not when not only Deep Prasad and El Bruno, but millions and millions of people around the world who have had the contact experience are speaking out. We're in contact. It is happening. This is what it is. But with whom? Well, that's the question that has not been answered yet, and it's going to take some of our very, very best minds, people like Ed and Deep, to dimensionalize this for us. And academics like Diana Pasulka and Jeffrey Kripal to add the historical context that is so essential to understanding. Deep's company is called Reactive. Its website is reactive.io, and its purpose is to use quantum computing to develop more and more sophisticated materials. We don't talk about this in the show, but the ultimate objective of that is to create a situation where we can essentially build anything by altering atoms themselves. So it's a real cutting-edge company. It's 6 o'clock in the morning here in Los Angeles, and we're talking between L.A. and India, and there is a lot of noise in the background. It's someone moving in Deep's office that he can't control. We've done all we can to minimize that distraction, and I apologize for it. Deep, welcome to Dreamland, and why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about your company?
Sure. So my track record is all over the place. I've been in multiple fields. I initially started out roughly 6 years ago in the field of IoT, so that's called the Internet of Things, basically developing hardware devices that would monitor the power consumption of homes and then switch off certain devices and circuits based on the power consumption if they weren't being used. And you could do this remotely over the Internet. Back when I first started this, it was sort of very brand new. Apple and Google had not entered the space. They did about 2 to 3 years later. And so this product or this invention got a lot of attention from places, institutes like MIT and the University of Toronto, which is my alma mater. And so I spent roughly a year and a half trying to commercialize that. We eventually got to a point where we were offered venture capital to sort of get the product off the ground on the contingency that both my brother and I drop out of school. And so we weren't ready for that. And we realized that the best way to make an impact right now, at least to continue to start companies, is to move into the software world. So I eventually switched into industrial engineering, and I focused more on computational math. So I did a bunch of courses on stochastic modeling, deterministic modeling, modeling with differential and difference equations. And I realized that these skill sets could be applied to a wide variety of fields, including quantum mechanics and machine learning / artificial intelligence. So I started, I volunteered briefly at a neuroscience lab on where they were doing some computational modeling for rat brains. And then eventually I moved into cloud computing, did an internship there. And I got really excited and interested in things like such as blockchain. It's a new type of computer science. You can say technology mixed with economics. And however, what I found was that it was a bit primitive and not exactly something that's going to change the world in the way that I wanted to sort of make an impact. So I really got into artificial intelligence more, and I focused on that. And eventually I landed a job with the Royal Bank of Canada. It's the biggest bank in Canada, as an AI engineer. And we filed multiple patents through the bank. I was the lead engineer on it. My name is on the patent. There's five other people who almost did nothing, but they're on it anyways.
That happens.
And yeah, I found that out the hard way. some of these guys, none of them actually touch a line of code, but it is what it is. And so this gave me a lot of notoriety. I can't pronounce the word, but it basically gave me a lot of street cred, and they gave me a beautiful return offer to the bank after I graduated. And so that was my initial plan, that I would go to RBC and I would lead the AI division for their wealth management branch. And so that's what I did for about 4 days. until, and this is what I've mentioned before, like, and I like to mention is that it took me 4 days to finally just walk away, because the day that I left was the day that an application was due to the world's first quantum computing incubator. And so these guys were taking the world's top 40 scientists, and they would train them on the fundamentals of quantum information if they didn't have a background, quantum mechanics, quantum computing, and how it ties into machine learning. And they would also train you on how to use all these different quantum hardware devices. So I eventually got into this program, and my company got funding. I passed through all their tests and whatnot, proved that I was, you know, technically competent in quantum computing. And ever since then, I've been trying to get this company off the ground. I've made a huge amount of connections across the field with Tesla, NASA, SpaceX, you name it. And so what we're doing now is just trying to hone in on one specific, I guess, line of product that we can focus on. It's all mostly based on computational fluid dynamics enhancements for the most part. And then there's also quantum mechanics simulations and thermodynamic simulations that we're also offering speedups for and developing. But essentially, that's my background in a nutshell. It's hardware engineering, Internet of Things devices, and as well as quantum computing. And also, I would say, you know, I also do a lot of research in quantum mechanics in general. I don't get paid for it, but that is my inherent and original passion that got me into all of this. And so that never stopped.
Okay, so you come to this experience kind of unexpectedly. Give us an idea of what happened to you.
Right. So I guess to make a very long story or a very weird story short, I was basically, you know, I had no awareness of this field until a year and a half ago, or just over a year ago, since December. My interest really kicked off, I would say, in the end of October 2018, when I really started researching the field again. I was like, I saw this NYT article again, it popped up, and I had completely forgotten about it. And I started looking into things. This was the article on the Navy UFO videos.
Right.
So I had read that in 2017, and even then it kind of blew my mind that nobody was talking about it. It clearly said UFO in the title, and the actual IR signatures and all that were very fascinating. So, but I had school and I had too much, you know, already on my plate. And then eventually, I guess like my interest reignited. I started researching the field. I would talk to people on what I call UFO Twitter. UFO Twitter is like a fascinating place because you have a huge variety of people, right, from skeptics to believers. And it was just an information overload. So eventually...
Is there any hope of getting it a little quieter in the background?
Yes, I'm currently finding a secret spot. Is this better?
Yes, it is.
Yeah, sorry about that. Yeah, we have some movers in right now. They're just so around between October to, I would say, beginning of December, things started getting weird, because at this point in time, I'm in a position where I believe something is going on, but at the same time, I don't. Like, I kept considering that, okay, what if this is, you know, what if Hal put off his scam artist? What if these people are all scamming each other, or no, you know, we're all delusional and whatnot. And however, at the same time, I was just constantly having the skeptic believer debates. And I started having some very weird bouts of sleep paralysis. We'll just call it that, because that's initially what I wrote it off as. And I'm still not sure if it was or wasn't. But and we can get into that. But so I had two bouts of sleep paralysis, one in November and one in December, and then nothing happens. And after the second bout, I was kind of freaked out because it felt so real that I wasn't sure that it wasn't real, right? It felt like, yeah.
Can you describe them?
Yeah, sure. So the very first one was weird in the sense that it's, I would say it's either sometime in November specifically. I just don't remember the date. But I went to take a nap, and I would say like 2 in the afternoon, And I was woken up from my sleep, and I found myself in the typical, like, sort of sleep paralysis state, except it was different in the sense that normally when I have sleep paralysis, I can wiggle my fingers and toes and wake up. It always works. This time that wasn't happening. And I heard this. First of all, I started feeling very blissful. Like, I felt extreme, like, not the extreme euphoria I felt in February, but it was quite extreme in its own right. And I heard angelic music. It was some sort of language. I'm not sure what language it was in, but it was, I can only describe it as some sort of opera, like some sort of, you know, like when angels show up. I don't know what the name of that music would be or whatever. But
some of my listeners will be familiar with this effect, but I personally have not had it.
Fascinating. And I know Greg Bishop actually mentioned some stuff too. He sent me some resources. Things like that, by the way, blow my mind that other people have these experiences. You know, they've had this before even I was born, right? Like, that's so mind blowing. And so I start looking around my room, and I'm kind of like really enjoying it. Like, it feels good, but I'm wondering what is going on. And I scan the room, and there's nothing there. Then suddenly my roof kind of like extends a bit. Like, it feels like my vision got deeper, or I somehow sunk into my bed more. It was a weird optical illusion of sorts. And I look to my right, and I see these two silhouetted figures. They're wearing some sort of cloak or hood around them, you can say. And in the top of the hood, or close to it, both of these figures had very bright, very deep blue eyes. And they were just staring down and looking at me. And I wasn't scared at all. I was quite fascinated. I involuntarily smiled. I think just because of all the, you know, I guess dopamine or euphoria that I was feeling. And then that was it. I kind of just, you know, passed out and woke up again. And that was that. So now, fast forward to near the end of December. And I'm now sleeping in my bed. And suddenly, I would say, I think it happened around 1 a.m. I never bothered checking the time as when it happened, but it happened fairly recently after I fell asleep. I get the same sort of feeling that, you know, something is happening. I have sleep paralysis, but this time I actually heard straight up voices, right? A female voice and I believe a male voice. And the female says, "Let's take him." And I start freaking out because I start feeling this lifting sensation, like air is going through my chest and I'm actually moving up, and I start fighting it. And I'm in my head, I'm saying, no, I don't want this. What if this is real? And suddenly that stops and I'm left alone, but I still can't move. And I do my typical paralysis trick, right? I'm trying to break out of it, but just like the first time, I couldn't. And I look around the room, and the next time I look and scan with my eyes, I see this massive, massive green finger. Like, it was green mixed with some sort of orange and silver. And it was very scaly. It was very thick. I would say about 12 inches long, somewhere between 9 to 12 inches, just hovering right in front of my face by a few inches.
A concerning thing to see, I would think.
Very concerning, because here's the thing, Whitley. I don't dream of, you know, non-humanoid species. I mean, I don't, and this was hyper-definition on top of that. So I wear glasses. I have a very powerful prescription, like around -7. So however, in this case, my vision, it was like it was enhanced. Like I was given an opportunity to study it. It was strange because suddenly my vision's enhanced. And I see that at the end of the finger, by the way, there's a claw. And that freaked me the hell out because I immediately thought, holy cow, if this thing is this big, I don't want to know what kind of body it's attached to, right? Like, this is already freaking up, and I'm given no context. And I start, like, muffling and making sounds, but within 5 to 6 seconds, I calmed down, and just my fascination took over. Because I was looking at this thing, and I'm like, I've never seen this before. Whether this is real or not, this is absolutely fascinating. Because it wasn't a typical, you know, scaly type of skin that we would see on regular, you know, reptilians here or snakes or anything like that. It was its own kind of, I don't know, skin type, you can say. And one of the thoughts that I thought in my head was, if this was in the 1700s, I would say that this belongs to a demon. That happens, and I think I had probably about a total of 10 seconds to study this thing. And I kind of just like lost consciousness or went back to sleep or passed out, whatever you want to call it. And I woke up on my bed just flying. Here's the thing, because that felt so realistic, because that I was woken up in my sleep, I was kind of freaked out for the following month and a half, because every now and then I would think, right, like, what if this is real? Like, what if...
I wonder if what you're describing is what people in the close encounter experience call a reptilian.
I think it kind of matches the description, but I also wonder if it could match the description of what people regularly call as praying mantises or what have you.
That could easily be it, but, you know, there's sort of not enough information. It was just a slow glimpse, but a glimpse of a detail. But how fascinating and strange and, frankly, frightening it must have been. But so far, what you're describing does fit the profile of sleep paralysis. Admittedly, it's a pretty unusual sleep paralysis, but it does fit that profile.
That's exactly right. That's exactly it. So fast forward to February 1st. I'm working in my room. I've been up for a couple hours, at least 2 hours, and I've been sending emails. This is my usual morning routine, by the way, right? So, like, I do all my, as a CEO, I try to get all my admin work out of the way as soon as possible. So my first half of the day is always spent doing all of that. So then I can get to the hard stuff, the real science and the real research. And so that's what I was doing. And I take a break and I put my laptop down. And suddenly I feel this same sort of sensation of being in sleep paralysis, except the problem was that I hadn't gone to sleep. That was the most baffling part. And I started freaking out because, and I mentioned this in my Twitter thread, I immediately started running through all the different possibilities that was going on. I thought that I was about to die. I thought that I was having a seizure, some sort of, I don't know, bout or attack, something like that. Because when you lose full body control and you weren't doing anything specifically, it's totally freaky, right? Like, I thought there was something healthily wrong with me. And the thing is, I was only given about 2 seconds to think of these thoughts. I was also, for some reason, there was half of me that, it's weird, I don't know how to describe it. Maybe you'll know what I'm talking about. I knew what was going to happen. That's the other strange thing. Like, I kind of understood fully what was going to happen next.
It almost sounds like you were sort of in a different place in the time stream or had a different perspective on time at that point.
Yeah, that's definitely one way to put it. And so I start looking around my room and scanning, because at this point only my eyes are functionally, you know, able to move or do anything. And I scanned a couple times, about 2 or 3 times. Then by the time I like scanned and saw the middle of my room, I see these beings materialize. First, it was one little white-suited creature. Let's just call them creatures for now. And then 2 other ones, exact same size, exact everything, materialized on its left and right side. And I was like, there's no way that just happened. And I start freaking out even more. I was like, wait, is this real? Like, I've been, you know, like, there's no way. Like, there's just, I knew almost instantly that this is kind of what people have been referring to, right, as the grays. And my first comment to myself was that they're not even gray. Like, these are pure white suits that they're wearing. And I was so skeptical that this was real, you know, like the, and here's the funny part. So like, I figured that I was so confident that this was just a random hallucination that if I looked around enough, it would be gone, right? I had nothing to worry about. So that's exactly what I did. You know, I scanned a little bit more and now they're just moving around like freely around my room. And I realized, holy crap, like this is not going away. I'm wiggling my toes and everything. Nothing's changing.
This is basically broad daylight. You're wide awake and this is happening.
Correct. This is happening at 9:40 in the morning. And my curtains are wide open, right? There's like light pouring from my curtains into my entire room. It's like, you know, like imagine literally like you don't even need to imagine because you are an experiencer, but when something physical just shows up and starts walking around your room, it doesn't matter what people will tell you. That is freaky, right?
Oh, yes. Freaky would be one word that works. But probably even yet, it's going to take a long journey, I think, to get used to something like that. exploring journey.
Very much. I could see that. I could absolutely see that because, and tell me if you can relate to this, but I start like trying to, you know, move and do my own thing. But every time I did, I would feel restricted, you know, held back. And I realized, dang, like I am in no control right now. Whatever these things are have full control over me. And that is absolutely terrifying. It is not a feeling you can just get used to it instantly, because you know that you don't know what these are. You don't know what they want from you, right? You don't know the intent. You don't know if you're going to live, you know, they're going, if you might just freak them out and they'll just kill you, right? Like I was like, my family would have no idea what happened to me for all they know. So I start I start freaking out, like I said, a little bit more, especially because it's finally dawned on me that these things aren't going away. And no matter what's going on, it's a problem that I have to deal with. And they start beaming these hieroglyphs. I call them a marriage of Japanese and Egyptian. And they're like sort of hovering. So it's three-dimensional, right? They're flipping from bottom to up whenever they change a sentence, and it changes between sentences and paragraphs. And it's being beamed initially right in front of my room. So like I would say a couple inches off my wall, just hovering there above their heads. And then there was at one point near the end of my experience, it doubled. So there was a second pair of sentences and paragraphs that were being shown like just inches from my face. And it was like some crazy sort of virtual reality / augmented reality experience, because it was obviously not physically there, right? Like I doubt if I try to touch it, I could touch it. It clearly seemed like it was coming from my own mind or something. But the hard part is it's so hard to tell, right? Everything seems so physically real. So I start looking around, and at this point, I'm both fascinated, kind of scared still for my life, just because I realize that I have, like I said, no control here. And see, I'm very much, you know, trying to study them, trying to understand what these things are. Because whenever I had read about the grays, right, like I did read about that in my 2 or 3 months of research, I had always visualized, you know, this gray sort of skin biological entities, you know, they would have uneven eyes, stuff like that. But this was nothing like that. It was actually very brilliant white uniform suits. And they had these like dancing, changing golden holograms in the center, some sort of insignia, you can say. It was constantly changing. Very, very pretty to look at. These hieroglyphs, they're changing and flipping every second. Like they're moving way too fast. I could catch some symbols, but it was frustrating because none of it made sense to me. And every now and then, some of these symbols or these sentences, I could recognize a word, or, well, it's an acronym, but it was in clear capital letters, the words DNA. I had seen that at least 3 or 4 times throughout this whole experience. 3 times in the actual sentences, and then the 4th time was when the gray finally jumps up onto the bed and it comes walking towards me. There was these symbols that were just dancing around its arm, like its shoulder, and it was just revolving in circles and swiveling around both arms. And one of the symbols, again, said DNA. So I interpreted that at the time. My first thought was, what if it's trying to say that we're related by DNA? That was my initial guess. Now I'm not so sure about that. And by the way, like by the time it finally got close to me, I realized like instantly that, you know, these are not aliens. And this is the way that my whole like senses, everything, the way that it looks right now, it's so also etheric. It's so weird. You know what I mean? Like it could sometimes almost phase out almost completely out of reality. And I could only see like a little bit of the silhouette of it. Like I could still see it. You know what I mean? But not fully.
It sounds like the one way to put this is that this has got something that has an entirely different relationship to reality. I mean, it's physical, yes, but it's more projected into the physical. Or is that your impression?
You put it beautifully. Exactly. It looks like it's, you know, sometimes it chooses to be completely physically here and real, and other times not so much, kind of halfway. I mean, the fact that like they even literally appeared out of nowhere, right, says something. Like whether some sort of transporter technology or psychotronic weapon, we don't know, right? That's where the we really have to tackle this with our best scientific tools to figure out where the hell do these guys come from, right? Like I want to eventually travel to their world. I don't want it to just be that they come from wherever they are and visit us. Eventually, we should be able to build some sort of, you know, doorway.
I think that you probably became part of this because somebody, maybe them on the other side, thinks you could be a big factor in building this doorway deep. I find that incredibly exciting because, I mean, talk about the right person to be working on and thinking about this.
That's an interesting perspective. I mean, and by the way, props on how you describe it. That's exactly right. Like what for, let's say I have 10 qubits, then you would need 2 to the 10 classical bits to represent that qubits. And we wonder, where does nature store all that extra information? We can't directly access a quantum information when it's in a superposition. There's all this extra information, but all we can ever see is the classical part of it. And so where is that? You know, how, what is the nature of the wave function? Truly, we don't understand that. We just don't know where the information goes.
So the more I hear you talk, the more I understand why it is that you in particular, like Ed in particular, have been ended up involved in this. And it gives me an idea of where this might be going in terms of other scientists, because someone is seems to almost to be trying to challenge you from the other side to find a way across a kind of gap in reality, and they're on the other side of the gap, and we're on this one, and someone who really is working down deep in the nature of what reality is, and not only what it is, but also how to manipulate it. And, you know, we do that with information and with ultra high levels of understanding and the use of things like artificial intelligence. So it's like someone is kind of challenging you to say, let's get this done. Let's make contact work. I think maybe the best way to put it is you've been activated.
That's beautifully put. Activated indeed.
Yeah. And here you are.
Yeah, here I am.
Yeah, right.
And by the way, I just want to wrap up the thing. Like the one thing that stood out to me, and I mentioned the email to you, is the way that you described the slit. That's exactly right. Like the letters come out as if they're a slit in middle of the air. Just boom, they're you're suddenly seeing the entire line, right? Or like a full paragraph. That was fascinating. And the other thing that I guess just to wrap off the experience was that by the time this comes to my head, I feel this huge rush of euphoria. Never felt anything like it. And I just get all this, I don't know, universal awareness. That's what I call it. Or oneness. And again, these words, even the idea of the spirit meant absolutely nothing to me before this. So that was very strange in itself, that my beliefs quite literally changed overnight, or you can say over day. Throughout the day, actually, after this experience ended, I was completely baffled. That it was all I could think about. Like, how the hell did this happen? You know, what just went down? And, you know, it just, it just completely changes you. It makes you, at the very least, more confident that you're on the right track. Like, I realized, damn, like, there is something going on, and I need to find out what it is. And so I booked a ticket to the SCU conference where I finally met Hal in person, realized exactly what you just said, that this man is very brilliant. He is no scam artist at all. These people are very, they know what they're talking about. And so, you know, here I am 1 year later, still trying to figure out what happened. But people like you and I and these discussions bring that closer.
Especially to find ways of making use of the mystery. In other words, you now know that this is there. What to do with it, or can anything be done? In my own life, I went from being terrified to really wanting this relationship. But the questions are also there. They're fundamental to the relationship. The closer I get to the visitors, deeper the questions become. It's so fascinating, and yet you can't quite put your finger on it. You can't nail it down or pin it down. It's a sort of delicious agony.
That's a great way to put it. Delicious agony. Yes.
Yes.
And a delicious agony that very few people can understand. You know, many people, my loved ones, my colleagues, so many of them are hardcore scientists, many of them millionaires. They are wondering what the heck just happened to Deep, right? But, you know, what can I say, right? Like one day though, I hope that, and I'm positive, one day they will see that I was, you know, people like you and I, we were on the absolute cutting edge of human knowledge. And I think that day is coming faster and faster as we speak. So
you are literally at the practical frontier insofar as this can be concretized. I think you've got the tools to quite possibly make some concrete knowledge out of this.
I would agree with that. It is right now you're right. It is the frontier of science. It's where our knowledge kind of ends.
This is also indeterminate. It's as if it's a quantum physical reality at the sort of at the macro level, like the wave function is a living, breathing part of the classical world, the big world. But, you know, this isn't a science show, and I'm not going to go into so much into the science of it, except to say that the way you understand and deal with indeterminacy exactly parallels what everyone who is in the visitor experience has in their experience every day of their lives.
That's a good point. We don't have the brains right now to grasp it. Like, you know, I believe I read somewhere where you talk about they kind of live in a world of possibilities. Is that correct? Whereas we live
Yes.
in probabilities.
Right.
That sounds about right. Like, it's like they can access the information directly, period. And we, you know, experiencers such as us, we get to see that very briefly, and it totally warps our mind when we see it. That, holy cow, like, this is pure information. And so, you know, that's, I think part of why maybe the euphoria comes is that you need some sort of coddling. I think it's, or possibly it's something deeper than that. I don't know personally, but, you need to somehow create padding for a typical human mind, right? It's like if I interface with a chimpanzee right now and I started sending it all my thoughts of quantum mechanics, it would freak out. It would have no idea what's going on.
I think the difference between the chimpanzee and us is the chimpanzee can never have an idea of what's going on, but we can. I think we can figure it out.
Wow. I think you're right. And that makes me wonder, are we slowly becoming the phenomena ourselves? Is that what this is about?
How fascinating. Expand on that.
So think about what I think about right now is that look at the way that let's go back into just UAPs for a second, UFOs. A lot of it, the information that they have to be computing would be immense. They have to have the entire, you know, galactic network loaded up in their database because all the stars are constantly changing positions, assuming that they do move through space in the first place. And even if they're not, they have to be able to compute all that information, right? They may be using something even more powerful than quantum computers. Although we do know that at base reality, information is quantum. And then if you look at the trends, our technological trends, we're constantly improving our AI. It's, you know, it's increasing right now. It's a little bit of a stalemate, stagnated. But we were also developing our own quantum computers. We're also developing things like Neuralink. Eventually, we'll be able to interface directly with the information that reality presents to us and make sense of it. And it feels like that's exactly what the phenomena does. It has some sort of, it might be technological. That's my bias, right? It must be to some extent, but it might not be. But it somehow has the ability to make sense of the information that's underpinning all of reality. And that's what we're doing. We are trying to get there, even if we don't realize it, or most of us probably don't.
I think you're exactly right. And I suspect that in technology somewhere, there is a viable and usable link to it, like a ladder rung almost, that we can grab onto and it literally project ourselves into reality in the same way that what you saw lives in reality in probably a much larger sense because of the fact that it is both able to tunnel through time and also live outside of time looking in, which would be extremely useful because we would finally be able to, solve certain debates such as, the question of whether or not we exist, which has always been an interesting one to me.
True.
For strange reasons. I can't really explain.
Well, I've always wondered, you know, why does anything exist at all, right? Like, that's the fundamental,
right?
Fundamentally the hardest one to answer. And maybe we'll get closer to that answer, or at least that's a hope. Maybe we'll realize. So my own personal belief is that we created all this. You know, we're all sort of enjoying our own game here. And this is just level one. Like, everything else is, like, there's probably an infinite number of levels, you know, and even the phenomena might have stuff to learn. Who knows?
And so you're in a situation now, and we're just about to finish. I know you only have a few minutes left, that where you are in the scientific community, you are working in the scientific community, which is in a state of denial about this level of reality because it
does not have the detectors to detect it viably.
The history of science is a history of discovering things that we didn't think existed. Voltaire dismissed fossils as fish bones thrown aside by travelers, and we didn't believe in meteorites until they basically hit a village in France on the head. So we're like that.
Right.
Where do you go with this in your community?
That's a beautiful question. Essentially, what we need to do now is replicate the discovery of the EM spectrum. And eventually, I mean, put yourself in, let's say, Einstein's position. So what I'm sure, like, you clearly know your history of physics, but just for your audience, one of the things that Einstein really killed at and what we can thank him for is mathematically proving that the atom exists through Brownian motion. He was actually finally the guy who hit the final nail on his head that, yes, there are these tiny particles. And so he inadvertently helped discover the world of quantum mechanics. And it's obviously ironic because he rejected some of the implications, right, through entanglement and stuff. But until then, before, like when he was in university, his own profs would tell him that the idea of the atom was purely metaphysical. It was pseudoscience to stop thinking about it. And so what we need to do now is two things. A, create the math and the physics that describes the existence of the phenomena, that where the phenomena is a natural consequence of this theory, of this math and the physics. And then B, experimentally verify its existence. That's all we need to do. Once we do that, all of science will jump on board and we will enter a completely new world. So that's what I hope to do, or at least hope to contribute to.
Yeah, me too. That's why I called my book A New World.
Right on.
Listen, it has been so good talking to you, and we have to continue it. Deep is in India now, and it's 6 o'clock in the morning in Los Angeles, and I don't know exactly what time it is, probably in the late afternoon or early evening in India, but the fact that we're talking together so easily, despite the movers, I guess, that must have been in your office, is amazing. That we, even 2 years ago, we couldn't do this.
No, absolutely not.
And our minds are coming together, and folks, your minds are engaged. Many of you are people who are actively engaged and involved in the close encounter experience, and or people who, because of the world and because of the sensing exercise, know how to at least place yourself in a position where if your engagement is wanted, you're available. So we're beginning to come into contact with this other level of reality. It's happening. And now we're talking to someone who may be able to, will be able and is building devices which will so revolutionize our understanding, not just of what knowledge is, but of what it means, that we're really talking about the beginning of a whole new mankind.
Right. And to fearlessly just stand up for it, right? Once you know something is true, Like, you know, people like you and I, we might, like, some people might think that it's crazy that we're willing to talk about our experiences, but all it means is that we're intellectually honest. It's as simple as that.
Right.
I like to see it as the, you know, the saying that one candle can light a thousand. That's what we're trying to do here, I feel.
Right. Deep Prasad, deep in the contact experience of all the places for a man with such an extraordinary career and in one of the most advanced levels of areas of science there is to be. And I'm so glad to find you here, Deep.
Whitley, it was an absolute honor. I love talking to you, and, you know, I can't wait until we talk again. So,
yeah,
and I can't wait to read your book. Brilliant, brilliant. Okay. All right. Have a great day, Whitley.
Thank you very much. Now I'm going to play some of the night recordings I have made. Free Dreamlanders, we are signing off Free Dreamland now because I do want you to subscribe. The listening to these recordings is not absolutely essential. It's terribly interesting, though, and there's nothing like it on planet Earth at all anywhere else. It's a real first. So once again, I urge you, go to unknowncountry.com, click on the subscribe tab, subscribe, log in, go back to the show, go to 1 hour and 38 minutes, and it will all be there. I know you're curious about it. I would be too. In fact, I was astonished by it when it actually happened. It really is quite amazing. So do this now. Subscribe. Get on the program. This is important, and it must not pass by. Make your Unknown Country subscription your first New Year's resolution. And thank you so much, as always, for being with us, Free Dreamlanders. I'm so grateful that you listen to this show and come to unknowncountry.com and participate in our message boards and all that you do to help make the site possible. Thank you very much for listening, for supporting Dreamland and Unknown Country, and for subscribing, for buying A New World, for buying Afterlife Revolution, and for engaging on the website in so many different ways. You cannot imagine how valuable your posts and comments are to me and to many others. Well, here we are at the end of the year and the beginning of the new year. Next week, John Hogue will be with us. The week after, Linda Moulton Howe. Then we're going to go exploring in the Taos Caves. And 2020 will go roaring on down the road. Who knows what it will bring? I'd like to take this moment to thank everybody who works on unknowncountry.com, our news editor, Matthew Frizzell, our site manager, Amy Safrankova, Nikki Thomas, our subscription manager, Al Harlow, who does technical support, announcer Ted Alexander, and my colleagues, Mike Cleland, podcaster of The Unseen, and Jeremy Vaney of The Experience. I would also like to take this moment to remember some beloved friends who have moved on: Stanton Friedman, Art Bell, Ramona Bell, and my beloved wife, Anne. And now, here are the unknowncountry.com singers from a while back singing out the old year.
Should old acquaintance be forgot and never brought to mind? Should old
we're